morning. Jeremy Jones on behalf of Raven Offshore and Richard Gladich. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
Raven and Gladich have assigned as error the trial court's decision denying their motion to compel arbitration. And on appeal, the issues for this court are really quite straightforward. This is a case of contract interpretation. For the most part, the facts and the law are not really heavily contested here. There's no dispute about the terms of the yacht shipment contract. There's no dispute that the yacht shipment contract contains an enforceable arbitration provision. And there's not really a dispute about the applicable legal standard. And that is that a court reviewing a motion to compel arbitration first determines, is there a valid agreement to arbitrate? And then, does the agreement encompass the disputes at issue? Where the parties diverge is in their framing of the disputes at issue. And one of the disputes here is who decides the question of arbitrability, this court or an arbitrator? And the parties manifested a clear intent to have an arbitrator decide that
decision. You would agree that generally courts decide that question, correct?
I'm sorry,
could you hear it again? Generally decide that question. That, you agree with that?
I would agree, yes.
Unless there's some explicit statement that it's clear and unmistakable that the parties intended otherwise?
Let me clarify that. So I agree that a court determines whether an agreement to arbitrate encompasses a particular dispute. The dispute here is, did the parties submit to arbitration or intend to submit to arbitration questions of arbitrability?
Correct.
And in the briefing...
My question was, generally that's a court question for the court.
Yes, the court would determine, did the parties elect to arbitrate questions of arbitrability?
Unless it's clear and unmistakable that the parties chose otherwise.
Correct. And here, the parties manifested an intent to arbitrate by adopting or, agreeing to proceed in arbitration under the rules of the Maritime Arbitration Association, the MAA. Rule 9 provides that it is an arbitrator, not the court, that decides threshold questions of arbitrability.
Is there a trap here for parties entering into contracts? Because those rules aren't generally attached to the agreement between the parties, and people aren't familiar with those rules. And it's not like the AAA rules that everybody sees with some frequency.
The language is very similar to the AAA rules.
I understand it's similar, right. But very few practitioners probably are familiar with that set of rules of arbitration.
In the context of yacht shipment, I would disagree. This is a maritime contract.
I understand it's a maritime contract, but we have a lot of lawyers that are general practitioners. They've heard of AAA, and they may have seen those rules. They're not likely to have seen these rules. Should the rule be attached when it does something as specific as this to submit questions of arbitrability to the arbitrator?
So the sole authority on this issue that was presented to the court in briefing is the Michael Perry case out of the District of Massachusetts. There, as here, there was a very similar arbitration provision which indicated that the parties had elected to be bound by the MAA rules. As far as I read the facts of Michael Perry, the rules themselves were not set out verbatim in the contract. That would be a huge contract, first of all, but there was just a reference that these are the rules that will govern. That court determined that that was a manifestation of the party's intent to submit to arbitration the questions of arbitrability. So that's not binding authority, but it's directly on point. I don't believe the parties have been able to find any other case that specifically addresses the MAA rules.
Is there a reason for us to distinguish between how the courts deal with the MAA rules versus, for example, the AA?
I don't believe so. In both cases, they are... fairly extensive set of arbitration rules. They would normally be incorporated by reference, or simply a reference to the rules would be made, rather than having a contract that says, we agree to arbitrate, and attached here too are 100 pages of detailed rules that set out how we will arbitrate. Instead, incorporation by reference, which is a common contractual mechanism, would be employed.
The courts seem to be making an assumption that if you incorporate the rules of a particular arbitration body, then everybody's familiar with them. And while that assumption might be true for the, I think this is the question that Judge mm-hmm. was getting at, that assumption might be true for the AAA, but on what basis do we make the same assumption for the MAA? I mean, that's a more discrete, sort of well-defined, separate practice of law, isn't it?
It is a more discreet and refined practice
of
law.
Some of the cases sort of suggest that where the parties are sophisticated commercial transaction lawyers, that you can expect they have that understanding, but where that's not the case, perhaps the rule shouldn't be applied.
Well, there's no evidence here suggesting that the parties are not sophisticated commercial entities.
Is there evidence that they are?
But there's no evidence either way.
So the record's silent.
I would characterize it more as FT Holdings has failed to carry its burden on that issue, because remember, the burden is on the party resisting arbitration. No evidence has been put forward regarding whether or not the parties were aware of the MAA terms, their level of sophistication,
or anything
like that.
We have one party that's supposedly in this business, and then we have what essentially is a retail customer of the business. We would generally think one would be more sophisticated about the practice than the other in that description.
I think, with respect, that's an assumption that's not supported by any evidence in the record.
Was the purchaser of this yacht in the business of transporting yachts or selling yachts?
There's no evidence either way of that issue on the record. This is a entity, FT Holdings, which purports to be the owner of a yacht, which arranged for it to be transported by ocean carrier from Florida to British Columbia, and that's all we know. So if this court is inclined to get into the merits and determine whether or not this case should be arbitrated, the contract itself provides two key issues which suggest that the parties manifested intent to arbitrate the particular claims that have been asserted here. As for the procurement of insurance, which is sort of the gravamen of FT Holdings' claims, the contract prices everything in one lump sum.
The argument here, though, is that Mr. Gladich induced the other party into this contract through a negligent misrepresentation. And isn't the case law clear that under those circumstances, that cause of action arises separate from the contract?
May I?
Sure, please.
There is an argument that FT Holdings was induced to enter into the contract. There is also an integration clause in the contract which says any prior agreements are essentially subsumed into the yacht shipment contract. So it's unclear whether FT Holdings is arguing, I would have never entered into the contract but for your misrepresentations, meaning the yacht shipment contract, or I would have never agreed to the deal for the procurement of insurance but for your misrepresentations. In either case, both of those agreements are merged into the yacht shipment contract, if there is a separate agreement to procure insurance.
When you get back up on your rebuttal time, does this contract have a provision that says I'm not relying upon any representations that are not set forth in the agreement?
You want me to address that when I come back?
Yes, I don't want to take up your rebuttal time now. And I also want to give you a chance to look at it.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors. My name is William Cronin, and I'm here on behalf of Respondent FT Holdings. There are two issues that have been presented to the court in the briefs. One is who should be the decision maker about whether the claims are or are not subject to arbitration. That's the decision maker issue. Whether a court or arbitrator should be making that decision. And the second is whether, indeed, the claims are subject to arbitration. Let me turn to the decision-maker issue. With regard to this issue, there is a very important fact that's been overlooked in the briefing, but clearly is part of the record and that is dispositive on the decision-maker issue. That fact is that no party ever raised with the trial court appellant's current contention that the decision maker on the arbitrability issue should be an arbitrator. Rather, both parties, without reservation or qualification, consented and agreed to the trial court deciding whether respondents' claims were required to be arbitrated.
Do you make that argument in your briefing?
We did not make that argument in your briefing, Your Honor.
We let you do that for the first time on appeal in oral argument?
I think you should, because it is part of the record. And if you look at the briefing, the way this issue of who the decision maker should arose, should be, the way that arose is in a footnote in the opening brief, appellants raised for the first time the decision maker issue. We then addressed the merits issue, whether the claim should or should not be arbitrated. Then in the reply brief, the focus of the entire reply brief was on the decision maker issue. So under those circumstances, Your Honor, I think you should look at the record and consider this argument. It's clear that appellants explicitly asked the trial court to decide that the claims were arbitrable, and appellants sought an order compelling respondents to arbitrate its claims. Respondents, FT Holdings, opposed that motion and consented and agreed to the trial court deciding the issue. But there is no suggestion in the record.
Are you making a waiver argument that they've waived the right to make argument one?
I wouldn't call it waiver. You can call it waiver, Your Honor. Well, I would say it's a consent argument. In other words, there was agreement and consent that the issue of whether the claims are subject to arbitration, there was agreement and consent that issue should be decided by the trial court. And it was submitted to the trial court without any reservation or qualification or suggestion that indeed an arbitrator should decide that issue.
And you're making this argument now, and opposing counsel has no opportunity to respond? I mean, did you give notice to counsel you were making this argument?
I did not, Your Honor. He can respond, and if the court wishes, they can allow a supplemental brief. But the conduct I'm talking about, I believe, has some legal consequences, and I'll let you go through it. First, when you submit an issue to a trial court, and you ask the trial court to make a decision about whether the claim should or should not be arbitrated, and you lose, you should not be allowed to turn around and contend, you know, the trial court should not have decided that issue. An arbitrator should have decided that issue. And why should you not be allowed to do that? Because you consented and agreed to the trial court deciding that issue. Second,
where would you be if we had said no oral argument in this case?
I'd be without the opportunity to make this argument, Your Honor.
And why should we have different issues in front of us depending on whether we allow argument or not?
Well, because it does go to the fundamental question under Rule 2.5A of what questions this court should consider. And under Rule 2.5A, this court may refuse to review any claim of error that's not raised in the trial court.
And that's a discretionary decision for us.
That is a discretionary decision,
Your Honor.
And we would
then likewise have discretion to decide whether to consider the argument you're advancing for the first time today?
That is correct, Your Honor. Third, even if you conclude that you should reach the decision-maker issue, even though it wasn't raised below, the law provides that the court should be the decision-maker, generally, on the arbitrability issue, unless the parties clearly and unmistakably referred that issue to an arbitrator for decision. The fact that the parties below, without reservation, submitted the issue to the trial court for decision is powerful evidence of either a superseding agreement to have the trial court decide the arbitrability issue, or evidence that, in fact, it's not clear and unmistakable that the parties submitted the arbitrability issue to an arbitrator. There is simply no case that the parties have cited that takes the position that even though the parties submitted the arbitrability issue to the trial court, there was a clear and unmistakable agreement that the arbitrator should decide that issue. Indeed, the Microperry case, which appellants have cited to this court as authority on the idea that the Maritime Administration rules should be treated as clear and unmistakable evidence of a referral of the arbitrability issue to an arbitrator. In the Microperry case, what had happened in that case is the issue had already been submitted to an arbitrator. A party had lost, and then the party said, I'm sorry, this issue should be decided by the court. And what the court said is, look, one of the reasons we're concluding this issue should be submitted to arbitration, to an arbitrator, was you've already done so.
If we reach the question whether this is a valid incorporation by reference that's clear and unmistakable, providing jurisdiction of the arbitrator, an issue to be decided by the arbitrator. What's your response to that?
My response is there's no evidence from the record that the rules were attached, referred to, or explained. From the record
that requires that to be the case?
Well, I believe the cases, all the cases that have looked at these issues, have decided have required some indication that the incorporation by reference was understood and that it was clear and unmistakable that a party had some understanding that the arbitrability issue was being referred to the arbitrator.
As I read the cases, the issue is whether or not the parties in their agreement agreed to abide by the rules of the association. And if they agreed to abide by the rules of that association, and the association rules provide that decisions of jurisdiction and scope of arbitrability are made by the arbitrator, then that is clear and unmistakable evidence that that's what the parties have agreed to.
I think the cases require a little bit more than that, Your Honor. For example, if you look at the Brennan case, the Ninth Circuit case, that involved an incorporation by reference of the commercial rules of the American Arbitration Association. What the Ninth Circuit says is, look, there were sophisticated parties here involved. There was a chief executive officer who was a lawyer at Jones Day. He had knowledge of the commercial rules of arbitration.
And is there evidence in the record here about whether or not the parties are sophisticated or not?
There's none.
Who has the burden of bringing that evidence forward?
Well, this case is before the court on the pleadings, and so we're able only to argue what can be inferred from the pleadings.
That the party resisting arbitration has the burden of persuasion once the existence of the agreement has been established. Your client acknowledges the existence of the agreement, so is the avoidance issue one on which you have both the burden of production and persuasion?
We have the burden to establish that. Well, let me back up. The presumption is always in favor of the courts deciding arbitrability issues. That presumption can be overcome by clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties referred the matter to arbitration. We believe they have the burden of producing the clear and unmistakable evidence to that effect.
I asked opposing counsel whether there was any provision in the agreement about non-reliance on representations of either party not contained in the agreement. Do you know the answer to that question?
I believe the answer is no. And in fact, when he referred to the merger agreement, the merger clause in the agreement, he referred to the fact that the merger clause merged prior agreements into the agreement. The conduct that we're talking about, the acts of...
It's not an agreement.
It's not an agreement. It predates the contract, doesn't concern the transportation of goods.
That's what prompts my question, because oftentimes in a contract you will see a provision that says the parties do not rely upon any representations other than those set forth in this agreement.
Let me turn to the merits. If the court concludes that the arbitrability issue was properly decided by the trial court, that the court then has to decide whether the trial court ruled correctly that the matter was not governed by arbitration. In that connection, we simply make the point that the claims do not arise from any duty or obligation a party had under the contract. The claims predate the contract. The claims concern the conduct of Mr. Gladich about the procuring of insurance. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Well, to pick up where we left off, Judge Leach.
Go ahead.
On CP23, the very first provision in the terms and conditions that accompany the yacht shipment contract, there's a statement that says, the yacht shipment contract and the bill of lading form are the only evidence of the contract of carriage. If there's a conflict between the two, the terms of the yacht shipment contract shall control.
Okay, there's no provision like the one I just described to opposing counsel then.
No, not exactly like that. However, we do still have the integration clause, where on page CP22, the parties agree that the yacht shipment contract shall prevail over any prior agreements.
How do you respond to counsel's distinction between a representation and an agreement? I'll give you an example. I represent that I am extremely knowledgeable about insurance and have special expertise in these kinds of policies. We don't have an agreement that I have that expertise. I simply have presented that information to persuade you that you should rely upon what I'm going to do.
There's nothing specific to that issue in the record or in the contract. The contract gets, I guess, touches on that issue, and I'm not trying to dodge your question,
but sort of explain. No, do the best you can. That's why we have this.
Right. CP 35, the final page of the contract, above the signature line, FT Holdings agreed that it had completely read and fully understood the contract. The language is completely read and fully understood by yacht owner. So to now contend that there's some assumption that the yacht owner did not understand that the rules of the MAA were being adopted, that they were bound to follow those rules and specifically bound to follow Rule 9, is not consistent with the plain language of the contract. FT Holdings signed a document that said it knew what was happening here. It completely read and fully understood that it would be bound to arbitrate pursuant to the MAA rules. Now, maybe it wasn't a sophisticated entity, if you want to make that assumption, absent any evidence, but it took that risk, that it didn't know what it was doing. So, to go back to if the court decides that the question of arbitrability is one that this panel should decide, everything that's before the court, and again, there's no contrary evidence. You're just looking at the pleadings and the contract, and there's not even an assumption that the pleadings are true and correct here. All you have is this document, which shows that the parties agreed to treat this, the procurement of insurance and the shipment of the yacht, as one transaction. It was paid for in one lump sum. There's no other document out there that sets forth the obligations of the parties or anything along those lines. This is all you have. Thank you. If there's nothing further.
Next up this morning is State versus Dennis.